This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Tuesday, April 2nd. The federal government pledges billions in new housing money. Most is for provinces and territories, but there are some strings attached. We'll talk to the federal housing minister about what happens if premiers don't meet the conditions. And former Liberal MP Han Dong addresses allegations China helped him win his seat in 2019. We'll bring you the latest from the inquiry into foreign interference. Plus, some provinces continue to push back against the federal carbon tax, while others take the feds up on the offer to come up with an alternative. Coming up, the Power Panel on those plans. The federal Liberals are challenging the provinces to meet their terms to build what they call missing middle homes. If not, new money allocated to address Canada's housing crunch could go straight to municipalities. Today, the Liberals announced $6 billion is going towards a Canada Housing Infrastructure Fund. $5 billion of that goes to provinces and territories to build more duplexes, triplexes, and townhouses, and $1 billion to municipalities for urgent infrastructure needs. Meanwhile, the Premier of Canada's most populous province is putting a wedge in those plans as Doug Ford ruled out fourplexes, rejecting a key pillar of the missing middle approach. So, how will the Liberals actually meet their promise of building more homes faster? For more on this, I'm joined now by Housing Minister Sean Fraser from Halifax. Minister, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the provinces have said they wanted a seat at the table with you on federal housing deals, and today you laid out some table stakes that Ontario has already rejected, such as fourplexes right of way. How are you going to get past the objection of Premier Doug Ford on this plan?
Well, first of all, the measures that we're putting in place are not specific to any one province. We actually published a list of best practices for cities to examine during the rollout of the Housing Accelerator Fund to lay out what we think communities can do to make it easier to build homes more quickly, to get them built at a price people can actually afford. When Premier Ford made his comments recently, perhaps he wasn't weighing in the balance, access to a $5 billion fund to help build out infrastructure to support housing growth. My own view is that we got to make it easier for people to build homes. One way we can do that is by saying a person who owns a piece of property is actually free to build homes for their neighbors during a housing crisis. I don't think it has to be that controversial an idea to incentivize gentle density with federal funding. And my hope is the government in Ontario and in every other province will realize that this is an opportunity to solve the housing crisis rather than just tinker around the margins.
So the carrot there is $5 billion for the provinces that get on board. And I guess the stick is that if they don't do it, the money flows around them and it goes to the cities and towns and municipalities of their province that are willing to meet these conditions. Have you had any feedback from premiers yet? I mean, how do you think this will be received?
Different provinces will react in different ways. There's already, if I take the provincial government, British Columbia has advanced many of the kinds of measures that we're now seeking to incentivize in other parts of Canada. No doubt there will be other provinces who don't wish to be pushed to do more on housing, and that will be their specific choice. But my hope is that if we come together, we realize that the federal government is willing to put billions of dollars on the table in an area that is traditionally within provincial jurisdiction, that there should be something in return other than just paying for the cost of a water pipe. We want to make sure if we're putting money towards infrastructure, cities and provinces are adopting changes that reduce the cost of infrastructure over time. When you build houses where infrastructure already exists, you can actually reduce the cost to local taxpayers through property taxes, and you can reduce development charges on new residents that effectively make it more expensive to build homes. So this is about getting a good return on the investment of Canadians' taxpayers' dollars and getting more homes built more quickly. And my sincere hope is that we can strike a deal with every province and territory.
So there's a billion on the table. So it's a $6 billion total announcement. There's a billion on the table right away for municipalities to deal with urgent infrastructure needs. And the $5 billion is for the provinces and the territories, and then that moves on to cities and towns if you can't get an agreement there. But Minister, how does that $5 billion get split? Is it strict per capita, or does this go to the municipalities and the provinces with the greatest need who move the farthest on these things?
Well, this is going to be subject to negotiations. My expectation is if we reach a deal with every single province and territory, the amount that each province and territory receives will be roughly a reflection of their share of the population. To the extent that certain provinces don't wish to come to the table and we're forced to deal directly with the communities who are willing to implement some of these changes. Perhaps that will be reflected in the overall outcome. But these are decisions that we don't have to take, because I don't want to presume that we're not going to be able to negotiate an agreement with province and territories, when in fact, my sense is the entire world has woken up to the opportunity to help address the housing crisis by making the kinds of changes that we are going to put on the table for discussion as part of these negotiations. And my view is that we should go into this with a sense of hope that we can achieve a deal with provinces in every part of the country.
You've put these conditions on the table for provinces at the very top level to zone as of right up to fourplexes on an individual lot. Further down in the announcement, there are conditions here for municipalities who want to get access to a public transit fund to increase their density and lift minimum parking requirements for anybody within 800 meters of high-frequency transit, high-frequency transit lines, and also post-secondary institutions. When you bundle all of this together, how many new homes, new units do you think all of this money and all of these conditions, if implemented, can help create?
Well, let's not deal in hypotheticals that may exist across Canada. I can tell you where our projections are based on these kinds of changes already being implemented through the cities that have received money through the Housing Accelerator Fund. Most of the cities, and in fact all of the large cities that we've reached deals with under that particular fund, have agreed to adopt 4 units as of right, have agreed to large density near post-secondary institutions should they have them in their community, have agreed to faster permitting processes. And with 179 agreements, including one with the province of Quebec, we anticipate that over the next decade, there will be an additional 750,000 units permitted for construction over and above what was already projected. So we're dealing with now an opportunity to make changes right across the country. And if we get universal uptake with all of the provinces, we're certainly dealing with hundreds of thousands of additional homes, if not more. This is a huge moment in time for Canada. We have to decide what kind of a country do we want to be. Are we willing to do things differently to make sure everyone in this country has a roof over their head at a price they can actually afford? I think we should be. And we shouldn't be afraid to try big things to solve big problems. I think it's incumbent upon us, those of us who seek elected office, to approach policies with these kinds of solutions in mind.
You say you don't anticipate resistance necessarily from the provinces or an inability to reach agreements. But last time we spoke, you were having a back and forth with the Ontario Housing Minister, Paul Calandra, over their affordable housing plans, that $350-odd million was at risk for their inability to meet your standards. Has that been resolved? It's now into the new fiscal year. Has that money lapsed? Are you going to send that to other people, or do you have a deal with Ontario?
First, just I want to be careful to clarify. Though I have, I don't want to presume we can't get to an agreement. I'm sure that there will be some provinces that offer pushback, and there'll be a set of negotiations. But on the specific issue that you mentioned, my most recent piece of correspondence to Minister Calandra offered a conditional approval of the $357 million to Ontario. But the condition would require that they demonstrate how they're actually going to build the affordable housing units that they are bound to build under the agreement that they signed previously and were given a 1-year extension on. To date, we have not yet had a response from the Government of Ontario to the offer of a conditional approval. My hope sincerely was that they were going to take the opportunity to respond, accept the federal money, and then get busy building the houses that they've agreed to build. We will have a decision to take imminently if there is no response from the Government of Ontario regarding this approval, and we'll be sure to keep you apprised of any final decisions that may be taken.
Okay, Minister, one last question, and this has to do with the whole carbon pricing challenge. And the Premier of Nova Scotia, Tim Houston, has bundled together a series of various plans that Nova Scotia has put out on the climate file and have laid it on the table and sent it to the federal government saying, we think this is good enough. This is going to get the emissions reductions that you're looking for nationally and that we're looking for provincially. And this is better than having a carbon price. What's your reaction to what the Premier of Nova Scotia has put on the table? And do you think the Prime Minister should have this first minister's meeting that premiers and the federal opposition are calling for?
So first, I've seen a short summary of what Nova Scotia has proposed, but I haven't yet had the opportunity to dig into the specifics. One of the things that you've got to understand, not just according to me personally, but whether you look at the Supreme Court decision of last year, whether you talk to climate scientists, whether you talk to those who've examined climate policy for their entire lives, most of them will conclude that carbon pricing remains the most effective way to reduce emissions, both across across the system and at a household level. To the extent that any province moves forward with a plan that allows people to pollute for free, they're going to be doing it at their own peril, not just to our environment, but in a way that is more expensive than putting a price on pollution and returning those rebates to household. In my home province of Nova Scotia, the average household, when you include the indirect and direct expenses from carbon pricing, will see about a $609 charge, which is less than the rebate that they actually receive. The average household will come ahead about $157. Though nobody's getting rich with a check for $157, they are going to be seeing effective climate policy put into place and be left better off at the end of the year. There's a lot of misinformation out about that, but my hope is that the government of Nova Scotia would not insist that it's free to pollute as part of their climate plan. I think a plan that that allows pollution to be free is missing perhaps the greatest opportunity to make progress on the climate change of the generation.
But, you know, Minister, you're putting out these housing proposals that are going to require negotiations and cooperation and agreement with the provinces while they're all pushing back on climate issue, arguing over affordability. There is a tension in the Federation right now. Do you think a meeting on carbon pricing, carbon tax, climate plan at the First Minister's level could help clear the air on some of this and maybe find a common path forward?
There has been tension between the provinces and federal government since Confederation. In fact, the system was designed to bring some of these issues to the fore so they can be debated in public, so we can come to resolutions. My sense is if a First Minister's meeting is being requested to relitigate conversations that have played out over the course of several years, three successive federal elections, and only now is coming to debate the same question over and over, I question the utility of such a meeting. If there was to be a conversation about what more can the provinces and federal government do together to reduce pollution and to address affordability concerns, those are conversations I'd always be willing to have. But from what I can tell, it seems that there's a lot of political posturing and very limited engagement in public, at least on the part of the provinces, to demonstrate what they're actually going to do that will be more effective, both from a climate point of view and from an affordability point of view. So to the extent that people want to have conversations, I just hope the focus is on what more good we can do rather than grabbing a political platform to get a video clip.
Housing Minister Sean Fraser, I always appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us today.
A pleasure's mine. Thanks so much, David.
The public inquiry into foreign interference heard today from independent MP Han Dong. Dong left Liberal caucus after it was alleged China intervened to help him win the nomination in 2019, in the Liberal race in Don Valley North. CBC's Karina Roman was watching this testimony, and she joins me now. So, Karina, he's a significant figure in this whole drama. What stood out to you today from what Han Dong had to say on the stand?
The most telling moments, David, were under cross-examination, in particular by Michael Chong's lawyer, who really started asking basic questions about his idea and concept and understanding of foreign interference, and not so much whether it exists or not, but whether there's even a possibility of it, and that this is actually something that the Chinese government is intent on doing. Have a listen to this exchange.
Do you accept that the People's Republic of China is attempting to interfere in Canadian democracy?
I've seen reports about that. I personally haven't seen any evidence of it.
So you don't accept it, or you do?
I've never personally seen any evidence of it.
That's not the question I asked you. I haven't seen any evidence of it personally myself. But we have very serious allegations, and we're all here because every federal political party agreed that a judge needed to be appointed to investigate these very issues. So I'll ask you again. Do you accept...
It's possible. It's possible.
It's possible. All right.
So that was a significant moment today, but there were other significant moments. There was a huge discussion over busing, and why that's significant is, of course, the allegations here are that international students were bused into the riding with fake addresses sponsored by Beijing to vote for him and make him the successful Liberal nominee, something he says he has no idea about. And in the conversation today about busing, there was a discussion about the bus that he says, if it happened, which he now recently recalls it did happen, but that the school that they were were attending, this private school that had mostly Chinese nationals, international students there, that they paid and sponsored for this bus, but that he did go and canvass these students earlier, but that they did reside in his riding. But then it was revealed that just yesterday he told the commission, oh, wait a second, my wife reminded me, we too hired, our campaign hired two buses, but they were for seniors. So a lot of confusing changing of information at the last minute, not a real answer on why he waited until yesterday to tell the commission about those two buses. So lots of outstanding questions there. And then as well, there was discussion about a CSIS document. And you'll recall that there were reports, of course, of this conversation that got recorded between him and the Chinese Consul General, I believe in Toronto, and that recording, there were highlights of that recording translated in the CSIS document that show that perhaps he wasn't advocating as strongly as some would have liked on behalf of the two Michaels, and that's a bit of an understatement. Now, he says when he looks at the points that were recorded and translated in this call, that it doesn't make sense to him because that's not what he said. He said he was a very strong advocate for their early release and for better conditions for them. He was also said that if anyone was recorded and didn't know about it, that of course they wouldn't like it. So he did concede that he wasn't pleased at the fact that this conversation did get recorded. And finally, there was a real moment when the lawyer for the Conservative Party asked him why he abstained on the vote on the motion to declare that what China was doing to the Uyghur people was a genocide. He said he abstained because he hasn't seen, I guess, sufficient evidence either way to say that there is a genocide or there isn't a genocide. So he thought the best course of action was to abstain on that vote. Those are just some of the highlights from today's testimony.
Okay, and that's just Han Dong. There are others who testified today, but he's a central character in this. He was elected as a Liberal MP, stepped out of the caucus at the height of the allegations against him to try to clear the air. What did Han Dong have to say about his future as a member of parliament?
Well, and on that resignation from caucus, he said that in questioning that he did not discuss it with the PMO or the Prime Minister, that he just had a conversation with the Liberal whip, and then that led to his statement in the House of Commons. In terms of his future with the party, he says he would still like to rejoin the Liberal caucus, that he did have a meeting with Dominic LeBlanc last September, but he said there's nothing to report in terms of what's come out of that. So it sounds like at this point he is still not invited back into the Liberal caucus. Today's testimony, you know, some might question whether that is going to be a possibility. There was a lot of pushback against his lack of recall, the fact that he didn't seem to make connections between the allegations about irregularities and the busing. It was confusing testimony, and either that he didn't really understand what was going on, he truly was unaware of everything, or that he didn't really even take a lot of interest in his own case, you know, in terms of proactively looking for documents that might bolster what he has to say. So all in all, it was telling in a lot of ways, both in terms of what he did say and what he didn't say.
All right, Karina, thank you so much. That's the CBC's Karina Roman in Ottawa. Well, the federal carbon tax increased yesterday in provinces that don't have their own carbon pricing plan. So did the rebate that goes along with it. The Prime Minister says he's willing to listen to any plans that meet federal pollution pricing targets, but some provinces are still pushing back.
With the Supreme Court judgment, it is clear that there needs to be a price on pollution right across the country. Any province has been welcome for years now to put forward a plan that meets the federal targets.
There are other ways for us to be able to achieve the outcomes that the federal government wants to achieve. The carbon tax has been tried. It's failed. It's punitive. People don't like it. Especially in the middle of an affordability crisis, it's got to go.
This carbon tax has to go. Or in a year and a half, the Prime Minister is going.
Okay, so who's going to win these political battles over consumer carbon pricing? We're going to talk about that now with the Power Panel. Emily Nicola is a columnist with Le Devoir. Michel Cadario is a former Liberal campaign director. Françoise Boivin is a former NDP MP. And Kate Harrison is a conservative political analyst. Michel, we saw... Heard what Doug Ford had to say. That's quite the pronouncement from the Premier of Ontario. Tim Houston, the Premier of Nova Scotia, has bundled together a series of climate plans that they're executing in Nova Scotia and said, look, this is better than a carbon price. We should be exempt. And Wab Kanu of Manitoba is apparently coming to the table with something similar to that. Where do you think that goes? Because it doesn't sound like it's going to include carbon pricing in any of its form, either through a levy or through cap and trade.
Well, you know, with the Prime Minister putting out the challenge to the premiers, it is interesting that, and as expected, I guess, that that provinces are going to step up and put forward what their plans are. But what they're doing is already baked into the numbers that we have. Mm-hmm. I don't see, I haven't seen the full detail, and maybe those will come forward, but are there extra measures that are going to make up that delta or that gap that taking away a carbon tax would do? And I think that's what the challenge is that the Prime Minister put to all the provinces. Each one in their letters also said very clearly how big of a challenge and how big of an existential crisis, essentially, that climate change is, and that we all do have to be tackling it. So, you know, now how are they going to do that if they think that they can do it better? I think that it'll be a lot of words and it'll be a lot of reiterating what they're already doing. And as I said, that already is baked into the existing plan. It was very interesting, though, to hear, something dug up from Danielle Smith from just a few years ago, talking about how great the carbon rebate was and how much more that Albertans were getting back rather than paying at the pumps. And I don't know why it took so long for that to surface, but it is pure gold. I'm sure it will be on mass repeat as much as possible as we get out there and into it. But you know, so far, someone like Dennis Smith hasn't put an alternative on the table. Neither has Doug Ford. Let's see what they have to say.
Well, it's funny that you should mention that, because we did want to show that, because this is something the Liberals have found to great glee as they have been getting pummeled on carbon pricing for a while now. They dug up this clip that Michel talked about of Daniel Smith from speaking with the Fraser Institute in 2021. They've been sharing it on Twitter like crazy. Just have a look.
I do my family's taxes, so I know we got $808.50. We get an extra little bump for me and my husband because we live in a rural environment. And when I go back and look at what I spent last year in carbon taxes, because I was working from home, I wasn't commuting, my gas bills were way down, and even the amount of tax that I paid on my home heating, because we're principally natural gas where I live, I would say that I probably ended up better off with that transfer.
Okay, Françoise, now look, there's some context around that. She's working from home during the pandemic. It's a different sort of thing. She says she was comparing it, she said today, to the provincial NDP pricing system that Rachel Notley's government had put in place. But that's an interesting economic analysis there from the Premier of Alberta. Does that change anything in this conversation?
Well, it will make for some interesting exchange in the House of Commons when the guys come back next week. That being said, I'm not so sure that the battle of communication on the price on pollution is not already won by the Conservative in some aspect, because it's such a simple message. Axe the tax. Now you've got Premier Ford jumping in, who will be, I think, in an election, in a campaign before Justin Trudeau. So it will be interesting to see. And he doesn't want to wear the situation. So he has to distance a bit himself from the governing Liberals, because he looks so chummy for the longest time. But for many people, it's still a big question mark. What does it all mean when the Prime Minister says, bring me a plan to compare with what exactly? Because to this day, and I don't consider myself an expert on price, on pollution, on carbon tax, and so on and so forth, and the rebate, I did get that point now that we've talked about it. So I think 3 weeks in a row so far. So now I got that point that Danielle Smith seemed to have gotten before me in 2021. But when you compare plans, what do you compare and exactly what do the premier have to come with to be sufficient in the eye of Stephen Guilbeault? Because yes, they're right. The Supreme Court gave them they do have the jurisdiction to do so, set a price on pollution. But that being said, what's the minimum? How do you achieve that? How do you prove that? You've got all type of experts. Those aspects are not clear in my mind, and right. I'm sure in a lot of mine, and that's why a lot of people go to the simplest thing, which is just to say, you know what, let's just axe the tax, which is not helping the environment and our planet one bit.
Well, Francoise, you got the point, but Kate Daniel-Smith got the rebate, and she said it was more than she paid in that particular year. And look, whatever they come back with, it can't just be emissions reduction on energy generation side. There has to be a price on carbon in some fashion to comply with the Greenhouse Gas Pollution Act. And that's why Quebec has cap and trade. BC has its own carbon price. None of the objecting premiers are proposing anything like that. And we're going to talk to Don Drummond and Steve Gordon later in the show, to the economists who signed a letter, who say that's a problem because you can't hit the targets without it.
Yeah, and so you're right. It is by design that there be some type of a price. And so I think what a lot of premiers are now contesting is, of course, okay, maybe we need to revisit that act overall and entertain these options. I think Francoise said, you know, she's not a price on pollution expert. Neither am I. Neither are most Canadians. And so what I think this will turn into is probably the tabling of a number of ideas from premiers. Well, what about certain technologies? What about, you know, helping pave the way to more alternatives that exist? And if the dynamic is ideas from the provinces that don't include a carbon tax, and Ottawa saying no repeatedly, we insist on a carbon tax, I think provinces are okay with that being the dynamic. Yes, does it not meet the federal criteria? It won't. But I think provinces are taking a gamble based on public opinion, and you know, I think probably the right gamble, that they will hear the public. They will see their ideas kind of repeated back to them in the public. Well, what are some of the alternatives? They're tabling the alternatives. Justin Trudeau dared them to. They've decided to play the game of chicken. And so I think that that's a dynamic the premiers would welcome. We've got all these ideas that don't involve a tax. If Ottawa says it's tax or bust, I don't think Canadians are generally going to respond well to that.
But, you know, Emily, no one has put out a robust actual proposal. What Nova Scotia has taken is a climate plan from 2022, an energy plan from 2023, a hydrogen plan, which is largely aspirational from December, and a coastal action plan from February. And that doesn't get the country to where it needs to go. And if everyone just does what is bare minimum for their jurisdiction, if we're going to hit these national targets, that's going to put an extra burden on Alberta. That's going to put an extra burden on Saskatchewan because they're the carbon-intensive provinces right now. So how do you think this plays out if none of the premiers are coming with anything that specifically measures emission reductions and the experts out there say you need some sort of pricing or it's just not going to work?
I think it's already playing out in a way that elevates the conversation in a sense that for example, now we can know that the federal government is talking about price and pollution, and Nova Scotia responded with things that, for example, have to do with climate adaptation, which is really, really important, but has nothing to do with reducing green gas emission. And so there's all of basically the different words that have climate on it, climate reduction, climate change reduction, climate adaptation, price pollution. Most Canadians at this point are not necessarily making the difference, or at least the premiers are banking on the fact that the population is not making the difference. So it's just green stuff, right? Green transition, green whatever. And so the government is asking the provinces to come up with green plans, and the provinces are saying, here is our green ideas that have nothing to do with the price and pollution. But at the same time, it starts a conversation. It starts a conversation on what the provinces are doing that is green policy in general, and what the federal government could help them, could do more to help them with that. Even if it has nothing to do with carbon pricing. And that's actually another interesting conversation to have. And also, it puts the onus on Ottawa to be, okay, but what about pricing the pollution? How are you also going to do that? And so it starts a back and forth. Kiapoliev is saying today we should have meeting with all the premiers across the country in Ottawa, which of course would be a terrible idea for the federal government. What the federal government loves to do is do one-on-one negotiation. And so if it starts off a series of one-on-one conversation with the premiers on green transition, I think that's already a win in terms of where the conversation in Canada was even 3 months ago, which is just axe attacks. Mm-hmm. And we'll see as well the provinces that do not want to have anything to do with green anything. And I will say that when we look at, you know, the carbon gas emissions dating back to the 90s, the two provinces that have done the least are Alberta and Saskatchewan. So those two provinces are likely to be singled out in terms of their lack of action to actually reduce emissions. And that is also a conversation to have that is based on facts, at least for change, rather than on, you know, this policy and whether or not people like it.
Right. And look, Michelle, there's a whole there are reasons why Alberta and Saskatchewan may be going at a slower rate on hitting the targets than other provinces, because if you just took, say, the 40% reduction everybody wants to hit and applied it equally to every province, you're going to punish their economy in a way they couldn't deal with it in the time frame that's available. So in some ways, this is federalism working for them, and that other provinces absorb larger proportional shares, at least in theory. But when you look at everything that's on the table, from retail carbon pricing to industrial carbon pricing to the methane's reduction and the oil and gas emissions cap, Canada still falls short of its 2030 target. It's within striking distance, but it's not all the way there. So, Michelle, you would need a really aggressive set of subsidies, technology, and regulations to fill in the gap from the loss of retail carbon pricing, and I don't know what the future of industrial carbon pricing is when it comes to a potential future conservative government right now, because that isn't clear to me. I mean, how much more would you need to do if you're going to hit the targets, or do you just abandon the targets as a national goal?
Well, I think that's a good question for Pierre Poilievre. Like, is he just abandoning the targets? He's been dead silent on that. And you said it very well. There's only so many things that you can do on the big emitters and on some of the other kind of elements of the carbon plan that gets you so far. A carbon price has been something that is, you know, getting us about 10 to 12% of our way to the goal that we're not quite even meeting yet. So, you know, I think that the government is kind of banking on the fact that A, they have to do something because they're in power and they have to be tackling the climate situation. Again, we're going into wildfire season. It is going to be tough. It is going to be brutal. And there's going to be a lot of Canadians who are impacted. Let's knock wood that there aren't Canadians who are actually losing their homes or losing their businesses or anything like that. That's a result of climate change. And Canadians know that. And I truly feel that they are going to be starting to demand more of their politicians than just saying to axe a tax. Nobody likes paying a tax. There's without question, nobody does. But, you know, I think with the campaign ad that Daniel Smith just cut in terms of the rebate, there's at least people that you can point to, and that actually helps to make their point that they are giving this rebate back. And so people are trying to stay whole. You know, provinces came forward, Fury from Premier Fury came forward with billions of dollars of asks in terms of infrastructure projects, that he thinks that this is the way that he can kind of get rid of the tax in his province and make up the delta. Well, that's just not reasonable. We have to kind of deal with the resource with, you know, a certain finite resources, and we can't just leave this problem unsolved. And so, you know, more and more, I think that the pressure is going to be on all the others who are being so glib and just saying, let's axe it because we can do it another way. Okay, so what is that?
Kate, I'm just out of time, but what is your sense of where the federal conservatives are on any kind of a national policy? Like, do they, it isn't clear to me if they, I know the retail carbon gone. Mm-hmm. Industrial policy, is that still a thing that they would impose from the federal level, or would they leave it to the provinces to figure it out?
I think they'd probably work with the provinces to figure out what that looks like, as opposed to kind of the 2015 plan, which saw kind of a top-down approach in terms of the federal kind of requirements being imposed upon provinces. I mean, Pierre Poilievre has spoken about the importance of different technology, you know, looking at, you know, diversifying the energy mix by supporting SMR, other things. I'm not sure that things are quite as, you know, substantiated on industrial carbon pricing if that's the direction they choose. But I suspect at the root of it is going to be how can we work with the provinces to develop something that applies for them? Because again, this dynamic where Ottawa insists that a price is the only solution, a lot of the things you talked about, the alternatives, were tabled in 2015 and 16 mm-hmm. when these negotiations were happening, and they were roundly ignored by Ottawa. So provinces are saying, work with us on the alternatives. We've got ideas. And if Ottawa is saying no, I think that's what Canadians are going to remember.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll get all the answers when they have that first minister's meeting that everybody wants, which I don't think is actually going to happen. All right. I want to thank you, gang. Thank you for being here. Emily Nicolas, Michelle Cadario, Francoise Boivin, and Kate Harrison. Thanks so much, gang.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.